to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. We could have won if we'd stayed. Well, there's a common pattern here. A, agreements rooted in unreality. B, agreements which presume unobtainable or impossible conditions. And three, agreements with unenforceable supervisor mechanisms and unworkable verification mechanisms. And D, agreements without moral suasion or any legal force as operative factors. All this, of course, must be put down to the substance of each agreement, not to the agreement process itself. It remains, however, a moot point whether, in fact, a workable arrangement was ever possible in any three of these. I have much more amplification on this, but I'll truncate it. The fourth conclusion, well, just let me say one thing about, well, I'll come to this later, story of what happened to me in a French embassy garden party about the Geneva Agreements. Anyway, the fourth conclusion is that a country's heritage, the character of its political culture, and the mindset of its leadership shapes the kind of agreement that is acceptable to and figures prominently in the subsequent adherence or lack of it to the agreement. The country's heritage and the character of its political culture and the mindset of its leadership. I'm afraid that that's what Washington has forgotten recently in dealing with the Mideast problem. I mean, any idiot could have told you that somebody would blow up somebody in Israel or in Jordan, either a PLO or an Israeli, to spoil the agreement signed, that Y, the Y agreement, W-Y-E. Some people were saying they would kill Yasser Arafat. Others were saying they're... You had people on both sides who denounced this agreement from the very start, and how, because that's their mindset. I mean, it's not that they're evil people, it's just their reaction to it. So the euphoria that we got out of Washington about this agreement was blown sky high out of the water. What Clinton should have said, instead of this is a great thing, it's going to bring peace and happiness to everybody, he should have said, somebody is going to try to blow this up within 2 weeks, I guarantee it. And if he'd been right, he'd have looked very good. I mean, it's not a nice thing to say after you've arrived at this, but it's the reality of it. If he didn't say it, then the spokesman for the White House or State Department should have said it. It would undercut the president. It's clear to the history of agreements reached by the Vietnamese, each was but a step on a descending staircase. No agreement ever led either to permanent peace or to improved condition. Rather, each was a prelude to a still greater time of troubles, and each agreement to settle one war simply set the stage for the next war. As I say, just one final thought. I may sound like I'm too harsh on the Vietnamese. I really like the little rascals. But it's clear to me that it's a singular society, and it's a product of an unusual heritage and an extraordinary recent influence. Voltaire said of Rousseau, he is insufferable, but that is his only fault. That's what I guess I would say about the Vietnamese. Anyway, they've long been dominated by this practice of politics of clandestinism, in which there is no experience or no appetite for open agreements based on open discussion. In the past, outsiders were to be manipulated, deceived, tricked, never dealt with in a forthright manner. In this century, Vietnam has suffered deeply from social pathology, buffeted by warfare and human suffering, social system fragmented, its future made so turbulent as to render much social normal behavior impossible. Increasingly, continually, the Vietnamese culture is now dominated by Hanoi and its values, which have taken on sharper edges. Society has grown more Praetorian, not militaristic, but Praetorian, and dominated by a leadership that is still anachronistic, fanatical, and a bit paranoid. All right, well, got a little more I'll use next time. This is probably more interesting, what Henry Kissinger told me about Paris agreements. Got very emotional about it. Okay, this is the day for your midterm exam. I think I probably have most of them. Next time I'll also have some materials on, additional materials on, I'll do two things. I'll pass out some things that may help you sharpen your interest in your term paper. And it also will represent the substance of what will appear in the final examination. Not everything that I give you will appear, but we'll give you a general list of subjects that you should know a little about and be prepared to address. And if you can address them, you can get an A. Any questions?
On that schedule for Thursday, it has you meeting the person like at 1. That's during the class.
Well, is it, where is it? You mean the guy from Hanoi?
Yeah.
No, I won't be there. I'm going to have dinner with him and lunch with him. And I don't have much time for these bone hunters anyway to begin with. Yeah.
I know you've given us a ton of time on this, but I thought it was next time. Is there any way I could send it in tomorrow or maybe later this afternoon?
All right, okay. Just drop it off.
See, right here. That's at 1 o'clock on Thursday.
I got a real third world operation going over there. Two secretaries who make a big point of saying on Tuesday, Mr. Pike, you have a lecture. Don't forget it. I said, yeah, thank you. Because once I did, I got a phone call from Gary Bell. I was sitting around chatting up a storm saying, why aren't you in class? And I said, because today is Monday. No, today is Tuesday. Terribly embarrassing. Anyway, so they make a big point of always telling me today is Tuesday and Thursday, but they make up a thing like this.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I can't go to this.
Okay.
He's just going to come over and walk through the place. Anyway.
I was just wondering why. Just
yeah, well, thank you for pointing that out to me.
Okay.
Use that as a one-upmanship on my two secretaries. Yeah.
Two things. One, I won't be here.
Is this going in Canada?
No, this is some residence hall thing.
I see.
Secondly, my term paper, I'm thinking about doing it on the Vietnam War, or how events in the Vietnam War affected the music in the industry, kind of like anti-war, but
going
to different songs, and like, because I've been looking for like, right now, like Rolling Stone magazine from the 60s and
yeah.
70s.
We've got some of that music, which you could listen to. I think it's at the archive. Thank you. And I think there are a couple of books on the subject. Looked up, you know, Vietnam War music in the library. But yeah, that's an interesting. If you want to do it, you can make a tape of the music with a little commentary on it. I never heard too much of it. They used to broadcast it on KFRS, Saigon. Did you ever see the movie Good Morning America? the music in that was just superb.
So that'd be pretty good then?
Yeah, that's fine. Just to play with the idea. It has to be
registered. All right.
Okay, yes.
I think I'm going to do my paper on the sudden shift in like late 1949, early 1950, of Ho Chi Minh being, you know, kind of like a rouge, maybe political figure that the United States might be able to influence to becoming an overnight, you know, evil communist, you know.
Yeah, right.
Shaking hands with Moscow, kind of.
Right. Well, you had these competing perceptions of
right.
him. I think generally it was agreed that he's probably a communist, but a lot of the French said he wasn't. And I don't know how they, you know, how do you prove a negative to begin with? But the hope was that he, Tito was a communist.
Yeah, Tito.
So he could be, he would be the Asian Tito.
He was in Yugoslavia.
Yeah, he was, and he broke with Moscow, and they broke with him, I guess. Anyway, he was, he represented the counter-Moscow force, and the hope was that Ho Chi Minh could represent a counter-Moscow, counter-Beijing, after China went communist. You got to narrow it down somewhat, I guess, into... I guess what you're really dealing with is his political thinking.
Yeah, his pragmatic.
I've, did you, were you here when I gave that lecture on Ho?
Mm-hmm.
You ought to maybe listen to this tape again. Anyway, I'd suggest that you divide it into two parts. Was Ho a Marxist?
Okay.
And what, you know, Marxism is various things, interpreting history, economic theory, and so on, dialectical materialism, and Leninism, which is a means of governance, has to do with organization, mobilization, and motivation of a society, not necessarily communist.
Right.
Taiwan was a Leninist society. A very anti-communist Leninist society.
Okay.
It's a way of governing. Ho was much taken by that. He saw great utility there, as I think he should have. So anyway, that's the main... then beyond that, the trouble is, of course, that you can't then answer the question, what is a communist?
Yeah.
Because you can't...
There's so many types of communists.
Yeah, you have to define. Right?
Yeah.
That's what I would look in there. If you say Ho was a communist or wasn't, I would look to see what your definition of it. But if you say he was a Marxist, or not much of a Marxist, or he's very much of a Leninist, or he wasn't a Leninist, whatever
yeah.
you think. I mean,
I was going to try to concentrate on, though, is the perception here back in the United States of because I've, you know, spoken to my father, you know, he was in Vietnam, and my grandfather, who was in World War II in Vietnam, and...
Your grandfather was in Vietnam?
No, not Vietnam, Korean War.
Korean War.
talking to